With so much of the focus during this election on the economy, U.S. foreign policy has largely been overlooked. But any change in Washington also has consequences in capitals all over the world. On today's installment of our ongoing election series, The Big Picture, we will take a look at how the U.S. midterms are being perceived overseas and their implications for a number of key global issues. Joining us now are James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, and Ryan Avent, online economics editor for The Economist, and I'm very pleased to welcome them both to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Greetings.
The headline on an article in the LA Times this morning was, "White House prepares for foreign policy challenges from Congress." I'm going to throw this out to both of you. In what ways do you think this election may shift U.S. relations with the rest of the world? Let me begin with you, Ryan, because you're in London. You're actually in some foreign post right now.
Well, I think foreign policy traditionally is one of the areas where the president has the ability to sort of set the agenda, regardless of what's going on in Congress. At the same time, there are a number of pressing issues that are really popping up in congressional elections, particularly of an economic nature, that are going to have some ramifications for the way policy is made after November. I think one of the key issues there is the relationship with China. Obviously, Democratic leaders like Chuck Schumer in the Senate have been interested in getting tough with China and pursuing policies there in order to improve the level of trade with China. And so it'll be interesting to see how Republicans react to that after the elections.
You want to add to that, James?
I think in the general perspective, what's striking to me is how limited a role foreign policy is playing in the midterms. You know, the U.S. has one major war in Afghanistan and one sort of winding down war in Iraq still going on, and those were dominant issues 2 years ago and 4 years ago, and are really sort of second tier in many of the campaigns. And it's, I think, from the Chinese perspective, I was talking to some people there just this morning. I think that there is a sense that however these elections turn out will probably be a sort of dampening of tensions between the U.S. and China, because the Obama administration has an interest, as do the Chinese, in sort of getting things on a calmer course. And the Republicans, if anything, will have less trade pressure on the Chinese than the Democrats might. So I think that I am struck by the limited, at the moment, foreign policy ramifications of this very contested and contentious election.
Last month, the House passed a bill that threatened to place tariffs on China unless it increased the exchange rate of its currency. That measure is dead in the Senate, but that may be revived. Is the Chinese government taking these threats seriously, or do they just see this as political rhetoric in an election year?
I think they take them seriously in the sense, you know, they were well informed enough to know that bill was a symbolic vote by Democrats in the House and wasn't going to be acted on this year and probably wouldn't have gotten through the Senate. I think they recognize that the U.S. has done something actually effective, which is lining up a fairly broad international consensus to convince the Chinese they can't forever keep the RMB, their currency, the renminbi, pegged as it's been for the last 2+ years when their trade surpluses are rising again. So I think it's not just the U.S., many European countries, Japan, India, Southeast Asian countries saying there has to be some movement here. And I think that's what the Chinese government recognizes.
And China has been attacked in a number of campaign ads. It has become one of the only foreign issues that has come up in this campaign. Ryan, the U.S. trade deficit with China is something like $26 billion. Would a revaluation of Chinese currency help a U.S. economic recovery?
I think that it would have an effect. I think that a lot of people overstate the extent to which it might boost employment here in America. I mean, it's easy to look at that trade gap and think that that's a big issue, but strictly speaking, in economic terms, it's not as big as other things, sort of like the overall level of demand here in the U.S. But I think that, you know, having seen the level of the virulence of the anti-China ads in some of these campaigns, it may be difficult to put that genie back in the bottle after the election is over, particularly if unemployment stays at a high level.
Has Chinese currency valuation been a major political issue in European Union member countries?
In some of them, it sort of cuts both ways here. I think if you look at the German economy, for instance, that's an economy that's heavily dependent on demand for some of the things that it makes, capital goods, cars, and that it's really benefited from strong Chinese growth. And then in other European Union countries, the level of imbalances within Europe is more of a significant factor. Whereas Germany has a strong trade surplus, countries like Greece and Italy have more of a deficit relative to Germany. And so those internal debates are more important than what's going on with China.
James Fallows, do you think that if the Republicans take control of Congress on November 2nd, it will lead to a substantive change in U.S.-Chinese relations?
Probably not, and I'll give you sort of the meta view from my perspective, and then what we might expect for the next 2 years. It's striking to me that in the 30-plus years since Jimmy Carter, for whom I once worked, and Deng Xiaoping from China, essentially normalized U.S.-Chinese relations, there's been more constancy in this relationship than there's been in almost any other aspect of U.S. foreign policy. There's been, through that time, with the even under the extreme tension of the Tiananmen Square crackdown 20-plus years ago, there's been a sense that the countries had more to gain by working together than by considering each other as enemies, but also that they would disagree in some very important ways. We see this even most recently with the selection of the Nobel Peace Prize winner, who on the very day of his selection, President Obama said, "We applaud the selection. We hope the Chinese government will release him." And this was taken as a huge national insult in China. So it's striking that the fundamentals of each country benefiting from partnership rather than out-and-out Cold War confrontation, plus the ongoing tensions, I think that's what we can expect for the next 2 years and probably the next 5 years.
Is the Tea Party getting coverage in the Chinese media?
I just was looking at a Chinese video about the Christine O'Donnell race in Delaware. I think this is being portrayed in China as, interestingly, an argument about why you don't want to rush into a democratic system, democratic in the small d sense of, I've often heard from Chinese people their sense they would like more liberties, freedom to speak, freedom to move, freedom to read, et cetera. But every time there are these kind of insanities of the U.S. Electoral system, including the rent is too damn high party, which got a fair amount of coverage, people say, is this really what we want to have? Do we need this now in China?
Ryan Avent, do you have a sense of what most Europeans are saying about the Tea Party?
I think a lot of them are very perplexed. Opinion within Europe is sort of divided on issues related to things like fiscal policy and the role of the state in the economy. But when it comes to some of the cultural issues that you see in some Tea Party ads, I think they really don't know quite what to make of it, particularly when it comes to some of the more the family-oriented issues, where I think Europe generally tends to be much more progressive than the United States.
For the last 2 years, the Obama administration has approached the recession from a moderately Keynesian perspective, increasing spending. At least that's been the attempted policy. But now the UK, Greece, Spain, even France have been slashing spending and introducing austerity measures. Have the US and EU taken fundamentally different approaches to the economic crisis?
Well, I think that opinion is divided on the question within Europe. And in some sense, the issue has been forced by what's happened in markets. We saw that in the spring when yields on debt in places like Greece and Spain and Portugal and Ireland rose. They really didn't have the luxury of talking about whether to continue with stimulus or not. They had to go ahead and some of those countries had to take steps to trim their deficits. Elsewhere, the debate goes on. In Britain, we saw just recently the new government has laid out some pretty substantial cuts to the state here, and of about £81 billion over the next 4 years, which is pretty huge. Those are not sort of universally supported. I think it's been interesting to see that there's been less of an uproar than for similar measures in France, where there's been widespread strikes, but there's still quite a large portion of the British public that isn't sure that that's a good thing with the economy as weak as it is, and would probably prefer to see those cuts either delayed indefinitely or at least put off until unemployment or the economic recovery looks a little bit more stable.
And I've heard that Keynes is rolling in his grave. I don't know if that's true. Ryan Avent is the online economics editor for The Economist. James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. We're talking about foreign policy as part of the Big Picture series, look at the current election cycle. James, our large national debt has become a major local focal point for Republican criticism of the Obama administration, though it's grown under nearly every post-war president, and in December, a bipartisan deficit commission is expected to release its findings, which will probably include cuts. So is the U.S. following the European lead now?
I think there are different levels of this to disentangle. I'm sure Brian Avent would say, too, if he were speaking now, which is the short-term stimulus question of whether there's been enough Keynesian impulse to the economy over the past 2 years and for the year or two ahead to sort of have the momentum to get out of the recession. And then the longer-term question of structural obligations and sources of revenue for the federal government and state governments, too, in different ways. And as you know, this, during the Clinton administration, those long-term structural balances were such that the U.S. was moving actually towards budget surplus by the end of this time, and certainly the combination of military obligations and tax cuts under the Bush administration put it on a different path. My concern is that the political discussion now about deficit lumps all those things together, and perhaps appropriate longer-term questions about whether the U.S. is investing properly for its long-term solvency are combined with issues about the short-term way to get out of the recession. And you could have, in my view, a misguided attempt to cut back in the short term, which would compound our economic problems, as opposed to looking in the longer term for solutions.
That's something that people have suggested happened during FDR's administration, I think the first one, when after there was a turnaround to some degree in the economy, immediately they tried to reduce the debt, and that kept the depression going a lot longer.
Exactly. That was sort of the turnaround or erosion of the 1937. And that's why the old mantra I was taught when I was studying economics in graduate school was that the reason that you had to wait until World War II to really get out of the depression in the U.S. was that was the only time when untrammeled federal spending was there was a rationale for it.
Ryan, will the world economy be affected if the United States goes ahead with major budget cuts?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no getting around the fact that the U.S. economy still makes up a huge proportion of total world GDP. And among the rich world, it's also performing relatively strongly. I mean, if you look at places like Japan and in the periphery of Europe, they really haven't experienced it sounds strange to say this, as weak as our recovery has been, they haven't experienced the return to growth that the United States has seen. So if the U.S. were to go ahead with substantial budget cuts, given sort of the fragility of where we are in the economic cycle right now, that would probably push us, if not back into the recession outright, pretty close to it. And I think that would have a big effect on global demand.
But we can't afford to keep on borrowing, can we, especially from China?
Well, I think if you look at government interest rates right now, I mean, it certainly seems that the markets aren't having any trouble lending to us. They're not scared at the moment. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one certainly is that the long-run prospects for American growth are actually pretty good. And so there is the sense that if America gets its house in order, it's not going to struggle to repay a lot of its debts. The other issue is that, as James said, there are short and long-term questions. If you look at the U.S. long-run budget outlook, it's really things like spending on entitlements, especially on Medicare, that are the issue. And so if you a stimulus program now to sort of bring the economy back to full employment is not going to make a meaningful dent in the long-run path of debt. So it would be possible to do more stimulus now and then, work on addressing growth and healthcare costs down the road and end up with a budget picture that on the whole is more sustainable.
Most polls show that one of the major areas of spending Americans want to see cut is foreign aid, even though it amounts to something like 1% of the U.S. budget. The administration has increased foreign aid packages to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and then there are these crises like the tsunami in Indonesia. James, will those packages come up on the chopping block?
I think the foreign aid rhetoric is usually intense during election campaigns like this one. When they actually move through the Congress, there are usually very powerful coalitions behind them. You know, certainly foreign aid both to Israel and Egypt is a very major source of our spending, and there are coalitions within the administration of both parties and the Congress, too, behind that. And the administration makes the case that for Pakistan, for Indonesia, et cetera, it's important to do. I would put this in the category of reasons to worry about the America's capacity for self-government when there is disproportionate emphasis on what is, as you say, about 1% of spending. And so we're seeing, I think, in this election cycle, a fairly advanced case of people talking that what people are talking about is at large remove from what's actually going on.
Well, there are pressures on the United States' relationship with Pakistan. I don't know whether Congress will get involved in that. But Congress does get involved in defense spending. Do you anticipate any attempts to cut that?
Yes, I think that is almost inevitable. And it's because there are deficit pressures in general, and almost every component of defense spending over the last generation plus, whether it's manpower costs, whether it's sort of cost of equipment, it's the ongoing costs for the wars we have going on around the world, they all have been building up so much pressure that here there actually is a bipartisan sense that this cannot go on. And so that would be where I think there will be partisan struggles over it, and certainly each party will blame the other as being soft on defense. But I think anyone who has looked at the budget recognizes that in addition to entitlements, which have their automatic growth, the defense budget, which now exceeds the rest of the world's combined spending by a very large margin, will need to be reduced.
The New START arms control treaty with Russia is awaiting ratification in the Senate. Nuclear arms reduction has been a pet cause of the president's. Is the treaty encountering much opposition in Congress?
There's been, interestingly, a split among the Republicans, where some of the sort of traditional George H.W. Bush-type Republicans, and Senator Lugar has been important here, have viewed this as Ronald Reagan himself came to late in his time, as saying that the cause of American security is actually advanced by trying to reduce the number of nuclear weapons that exist in the world, because nobody is safe as long as they are there. There's been no movement in the last while because another faction of the Republican Party has said, "Oh, here's a sign of weakness, and we can't afford this." I think that this will be an important area of negotiation, depending on what the balance is in the Congress, whether the Democrats retain at least the Senate, and how things seem to be lining up for the presidential election. But it is, I think, that there are enough Republicans who actually support this, as opposed to being a block opposition to it, that you could see some movement.
Ryan, the Obama administration has been pressuring Russia and China about Iran's nuclear program. I assume the START treaty factors into those efforts to bring Russia on board.
Well, I'm sure that it does. And I think that what the U.S. has realized that it needs to do is bring some of its key partners in international diplomacy into the effort to bring Iran to the table and do some of the things that it's looking for there. But I it's also interesting the extent to which nuclear capability is tied up with the sense of national pride. If we go back to the recent budget cuts here in Britain, one of the things that was notably spared was efforts to keep up Britain's nuclear arsenal, even though it's difficult to imagine a scenario in which Britain would need its own deterrent apart from that of the United States. And so I think it's difficult, really, to talk about reducing these things so long as you have a national pride on the line.
We have very little.
That's something that Iran is thinking about as well.
We have very little time left, but I just want to address this to both of you, and I hope you can make your answers as brief as possible. President Obama's popularity has eroded somewhat in this country. Does he remain popular around the world?
In Asia, in general, he is seen as more popular. They have not sort of caught up with the decline of Obama popularity that's happened as much in the U.S.
I think in Europe he remains broadly popular, but as tensions have grown within Europe over how best to approach the economy among some of the elite here, their view of him has soured as well.
The president plans to travel to India after Election Day. Do we know what expected to be on the agenda during that visit? James?
My My sense would be that a concern from India's point of view is always a parity in, with the American emphasis on China. India is always concerned that a very equally large, almost equally large country and the largest democracy in the world gets similar strategic, economic, and cultural emphasis as the U.S. is giving to China.
James Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. Ryan Avent is the online economics editor for The Economist. Thank you both so much for participating in today's segment of The Big Picture.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Great to talk to you.